Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. Leif Anger is a much-honored and best-selling author. You've probably heard of Peace Like a River, or maybe So Brave, Young and Handsome, or perhaps his newest, which he will talk about here. It's called Virgil Wander. Humanities ND invited him to do a public webinar on the book and asked me to moderate. This is part of a series called One Book, One North Dakota, and there'll be 12 total. Find out more about that at humanitiesnd.org. Special thanks to the Paris Family Foundation for helping fund this project. And now on to Leif Anger and Virgil Wander. Let's start with Leif reading.
Yeah, this is actually how the book begins. So I'll just give you about the first page or so and give you a flavor of how this starts. Now I think the picture was unspooling all along and I just failed to notice. The obvious really isn't so. At least it wasn't to me, a Midwestern male cruising at medium altitude, aspiring vaguely to decency, contributing to PBS, moderate in all things, including romantic forays, and doing unto others more or less reciprocally. If I were to pinpoint when the world began reorganizing itself, that is, when my seeing of it began to shift, it would be the day a stranger named Rune blew into our bad luck town of Greenstone, Minnesota, like a spark from the boreal gloom. It was also the day of my release from St. Luke's Hospital down in Duluth, so I was concussed and more than a little adrift. The previous week, I had driven up shore to a popular lookout to photograph a distant storm approaching over Lake Superior. It was a beautiful storm, self-contained as storms often are, hunched far out over the vast water like a blob of blue ink, but it stalled in the middle distance, and time just slipped away. There's a picnic table up there where I have napped more than once. What woke me this time was the mischievous gale delivering autumn's first snow. I leaped behind the wheel as it came down, in armloads. Highway 61 quickly grew rutted and slick. Maybe I was driving too fast. U2 was on the radio, mysterious ways I seem to recall. Apparently my heartbroken Pontiac breached a safety barrier and made a long, lovely, some might say cinematic arc into the churning lake. I say apparently since this particular memory is not crisp. The airbag deployed at the barricade snapped my head back and swaddled me in a whiplash haze it took a long time to shake off. I missed the lightning thoughts and impressions a person might expect in this situation. Cold panic, clenching denial, a magician's bouquet of vibrant regrets. I would have sunk with the car if Marcus Jetty hadn't been doing a little late-season beachcombing. Marcus runs Greenstone Salvage and Tinker, a famous local eyesore of bike frames, tube amps, hula poppers, oil drums, knobs of driftwood. He was picking along the jagged strand in his raincoat, eye on a fat cork from somebody's herring net, when a car approached on the highway above. He later described the sounds of a whining V6 and thumping bassline before the barrier burst to shrapnel and the world for a moment muffled itself. In the silence, Marcus looked up. A mid-size American sedan sailed dreamlike through thickening snow. So that's him. He goes in, and when he is pulled from the water, and after his week in the hospital recovering, nothing is ever quite the same for Virgil.
Leif tells us a little more about Virgil.
He's kind of been stalled out for a while. I think it's tempting to think that the second chance we need the most is maybe the one we don't understand that we need at all. And I think for Virgil, that's clearly what happened. He was a guy who could have gone on the way he was for a long time and not realized that he was missing out on some things or that some changes might benefit him. And so it's the story of a man getting a second chance he doesn't know he needs. And I'm tempted to think that those are the best kind. You know, we all want second chances all the time, I think. I'm always looking for a second or a third or a fourth chance at whatever it is. And so it was really fun to write about a guy who, you know, is in the situation he is, where at one point he says, for a man named Wander, I've been a long time in one place. And that's the moment maybe at which he realizes that, oh, this wasn't all bad for me.
Well, speaking of names, I had to ask about some of the unusual names that are in this book.
Names sometimes come to you first about a character before anything else does, and other times you never really get to the meat of the character until you land on the right name. In the first draft of this book, which I threw away, his name wasn't Virgil. He wasn't really the same character, but the main character whose voice you heard a lot was named Roy. And I knew that was a placeholder. I didn't really know what the name should be, but when I began the second draft, then Virgil, the name just sort of appeared, which makes it sound really mystical. But you know, all sorts of stuff is going on by then. You're thinking about it. I'm a sucker for the classic poets, you know. So Virgil, who's like the guide character in Dante. Showing him around the afterlife, I wanted that hint at someone developing a poetic sensibility, someone who already has a certain amount of nostalgia and is sort of who is being goosed into looking at the world in a broader way, widening his horizons a bit, and I love the last name Wander because it's for him. He hasn't done much wandering until this point. Every other book I've written has been a road story in one way or another. This is just takes place in one town, which made me really nervous, but I wanted there to be a lot of kind of interior wandering. And so I think that's where the real road, that's where the travel hits, is inside of Virgil. And you see the arc that he travels through the book. And also maybe it's aspirational. I think by the end of the book, you don't quite know where Virgil is going to end up. And that's a very hopeful outlook for a man who's been stuck for a long time.
I asked Leif Enger about the relatively gentle tone of Virgil Wander.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is a gentle tone, and it's not. Look, if you're looking for a book with a, you know, sort of a rip-roaring plot, Virgil is maybe not the one that you should land on. It's a character-driven book. I liked the gentle tone, and I think I landed on it because for me, and probably for a lot of writers, but I think we tend to write what we really need at the time. There's a lot of wish fulfillment involved in the writing process. And what I really was wanting in life at the time I was working on this was a place I could abide without being judged. I loved the idea of a theater owner because that was sort of a long-standing dream of mine. I thought it would be so wonderful to own a small movie theater, even one that didn't make any money, that you could just sort of run as a something generous that you do for the community. I always thought that would be really cool if a person could find a way to afford it. And you do see that happening here and there. So that was wish fulfillment. But then what would be even better? What if people who love movies the way you do, people you know, friends, would show up after a film and you would just sort of have lasagna? that's just something that sounded lovely to me when I thought about it. And so I wrote it in part because I wanted to feel it myself, and I wanted to read it aloud to my wife and have her say, as she did, "Can we have those friends?" and because it's just such a lovely idea, and I was feeling at the time alone, and I think Robin was too. We were both experiencing some loss at that point. We were losing our parents, which was difficult, And so we felt, and our kids, you know, had grown up and gone away, and as kids do, and they stay in touch, but they were no longer living in the house with us. And I think both of us felt a little bereft in many ways. So Virgil became an expression of hope for a future of friends and warmth.
I asked Leif about the small town of Greenstone, where the story is set, and the way that the town is almost a character in the novel.
I mean, Greenstone has a lot in common with other rural places that are beautiful, that have a lovely setting. Years ago, when I was working for Minnesota Public Radio as a reporter, I got sent up the North Shore to interview some people. And I was just, it was my first sighting of Lake Superior. Like I said, I grew up in Minnesota, but we only went west when we traveled. We didn't go east and north. So I knew Lake Superior was there, but I didn't actually see it until I was in my 20s. And what struck me about it was, it was so beautiful. My first and only thought was, how can I arrange to live here? How can I be on the shore of this inland sea? It was so glorious. The second was, actually, there aren't very many ways to do it. If you're going to get north beyond Duluth, if you're going to go up to Two Harbors or Grand Marais or anything in between, it's hard to make a living. There just aren't that many ways to do it. And so every book needs an interior tension, something that is working like this, against which you set your tail and your relationships. And that tension between a place that's drop-dead beautiful but really hard to find a way to live in struck me as a good tension. And a dying town in rural Minnesota, or really rural anywhere, is a common story. We can all identify with it.
You wanted to read a section, and this would be great to get off on a discussion of the characters in the book, about the Finnish doctor who treats Virgil for his brain injury.
After his accident, Virgil goes to the hospital in Duluth, and this is his encounter with the neurologist. The neurologist was a Finn named Koskinen, with a broad, decent face and a Teddy Roosevelt mustache. He diagnosed mild traumatic brain injury. This sounded paradoxical, but so did everything else he said. For example, the damage was short-term, but might last quite a while, or possibly longer than that. I could expect within months to regain my balance, as long as I didn't tip over, to experience fewer headaches, or maybe just get used to them. He said over time I would remember the names of friends and the nearer relatives, that I would recover fine motor skills, and pockets of personal history I didn't yet realize had vanished. Despite my confusion, I liked Koskinen immediately. He had the heartening bulk of the aging athlete defeated by pastry. He delivered all news as though it were good. Most welcome was his prediction that language would gradually return. Not that I couldn't speak, but I had to stick to basics. My storehouse of English had been pillaged. At first I thought common nouns were hardest hit, coffee and doorway and so on. But it soon became clear that the missing were mostly adjectives. "Don't worry, everything will come back," said Dr. Koskinen. "Most things probably will. A good many of them might return. There will be at least a provisional rebound. How does this make you feel?" I wanted to say relieved or encouraged or at least hopeful, but none of these were available. All I could muster was a mute grin, at which the doctor nodded with his mouth open in a vaguely alarming smile. That's his experience with the doctor. Just absolutely.
Yes, it's hilarious.
Just covering his hind end at every turn. which, you know, you have to admire a doctor who can do that in an entertaining way.
Yes. And, so this is one, and Dr. Koskinen comes back again and again through the book, there's a lot of characters in this book. It's not one with just the lead and a couple supporting actors.
It's an ensemble picture, yes.
Yeah, it really is. And one thing that struck me, working on this, I went and looked at some reviews, and the phrase quirky character was used with great frequency.
I think a couple things are at work here, and one is what you're getting at, that sure, they're quirky, but isn't everybody if you spend more than 5 minutes listening to them? You know how this works from your life. You know, you meet somebody at work in an office, or you meet somebody in a park, or they walk past on the sidewalk and you end up talking to them. And if you're paying any attention, they'll soon say something that will surprise you or delight you or horrify you. But in any case, will prove that they aren't like a dull stereotype. A number of years ago, we were living in a little town outside of Brainerd. And one night, there was a lunar eclipse. And we had a little 4-inch reflecting telescope, Robin and I at that time. And we were out in the backyard watching the lunar eclipse. And there was this guy who would sometimes stop in and see the lady who lived next door to us. Just a really nice guy, but I didn't know him very well at all. And truthfully, I didn't think about him at all. I mean, he just wasn't really on my radar. But he stepped out of her door, and he saw me in the backyard with the telescope. And I said, "Hey, we're watching the lunar eclipse. You want to come and look through the telescope?" So he strolls over with his hands in his pockets, and he looks through, and he admires the lunar eclipse. And then he pulls away from the scope, and he says, "You know, we never actually went up there. That whole thing, that's mythology." And I was so delighted. I said, "I've heard about people like you. Tell me more." And he did, and he was such an interesting fellow, and I never would have known, except I got the chance to spend a little time listening to him. And I think, you know, fictional characters are kind of the same way. That at first they stroll onto the page and you think, dull or worth keeping around? And then you just let them talk a little bit, and pretty soon you realize they're pretty interesting people. And that's the other thing that's very common, which is, if you're going to write about somebody for a year or 2 years, or in my case, way too many years, you better make sure that they're interesting enough to listen to for a while. That'll weed out the dull ones.
Well, which brings up Adam Lear. Do you want to read a little bit?
Sure. Adam is a strange one, who is fun to talk about. If the story has a villain, it's certainly Adam Lear. You had mentioned this part on page 114. I'm just going to read a little part of that. In this scene, Virgil is quietly trying to sell his movie theater. That is, he has listed it for sale in the trade press, but he hasn't really spoken about it to anybody in Greenstone because he doesn't want people to know. He's not really sure he wants to sell it, but he thinks if he's ever going to, maybe he should be thinking about it. So Lear has found out about this. At this point, just to set the stage, Virgil has just been to a follow-up doctor's appointment in Duluth, and he's waiting in a coffee shop for his ride to come and get him. And while he's there, Adam Lear appears. Adam comes out of a pawn shop across the street, and he spots Virgil through the window of the coffee shop and joins him. And he says to Virgil, "I won't keep you, but I'm glad we bumped into each other. I see the Empress is for sale." "Yes," I said, carefully wondering how he found out. "Most of Greenstone didn't know. I'd advertised in the trade press, both in print and online, but never locally, nor in Duluth, nor the Twin Cities. This discretion sometimes prompted my friend Beeman to suggest I didn't really want to sell, and in fact, I didn't want to sell to anyone who didn't read the trades. In a business plodding toward extinction, you better know the landscape." "I'd like to make an offer," Lear said. He appeared entirely serious. "You want the theater?" "I do." I took my time with this confounding news. He said, "I can't promise how long I would continue to show actual movies, but it's a very decent location, as you know, center of everything." "Such as it is," I said, "you wouldn't show movies? Virgil, you're getting 8 people a night." "What would you do with it, then?" I attempted to sound curious instead of defensive. Small-town theaters have been transformed into every sort of establishment, cafes and bookstores, bars, museums. Lear said, "Do I need a plan at this moment? It's potential that intrigues me. What things might become?" He leaned toward me across the table. I remember him talking about the nature of risk, the cost of inspiration. I looked away, not that his voice was unpleasant or sinister. If anything, it was nearly smug and savored the tidy phrase. Yet it sent me on edge, that voice of his. It seemed deftly persistent, as if it carried not just words, but a subfrequency, an inaudible current describing unspeakable things. Despite my resistance, I felt something give. I heard him as if through a layer of water. The coffee shop dimmed at the edges. "My point is," he said from far away, "you need the vacancy and then something can fill it. My offer is genuine and cash." And he named a figure. I don't remember how much. "Speculators make me nervous," I managed to say in slow, soggy tone. "What needless suspicion," he said. "To speculate is to imagine, to wonder." At least I think that's what he said, before a shape sank past in my murky sight, a watery shape, a descending turtle, and then I knew where I seemed to be, in my honest old Pontiac, 90 feet deep. There, sure enough, was the ovoid speedometer, there my drifting blue hand. A bit of my brain believed I was dead, believed in the peace, knew the wavery coffee shop was only the weak invention it turns out a corpse can summon. Relief rinsed through me, followed by a chiding phrase from the past, "Fight the good fight." Someone important had said that. Had I fought well? I didn't know. But what did it matter? The fight appeared to be over. So that's his very strange and perplexing and frightening encounter with Adam in the coffee shop. And as part of the Adam Lear continuum, he was a really enjoyable character to write. He was.
I think people would be surprised to hear you say that.
Well, he was so alien, you know, when you're inventing a character, sometimes it comes down to the name, like we talked about earlier. And sometimes it comes down to asking the right question or asking it in the right way. And for Adam, to get a hold of Adam, the question was, what if a person did not have any of the qualities that we take for granted in human beings? What if what makes us human is the capacity for empathy, to understand what somebody else might be feeling, or the capacity of humility, or of understanding when an apology might be necessary, for example. What if you just didn't have access to any of that? It was just gone. What if you made a decision young that was a quality you were going to jettison and you weren't going to need in your life? If you've done that, then what becomes possible for you? What might you come to resemble later in your life? And that opened the door for all kinds of interesting places for me. And it made him really fun to write about because I never knew what was going to happen next for him.
I asked Leif to talk a little bit about the uncanny elements in the book.
That's a terrific question, and it's a fun thing to think about and talk about. I think whether you're talking about miracles or whether you're talking about magic realism or just uncanniness, which I think is what you're getting at, is an uncanniness. Mm-hmm. I think what they all share is the feeling that most of us get at one time or another that there's more here than meets the eye, that there are things that happen that are not explainable, that not everything we experience is the result of an algorithm. I think there's that sensation we get, even the most rational of us, that there are forces at work that we can't possibly understand and probably shouldn't try to explain, because we're not going to get it right. And so I think, you know, I've been asked if that's somehow breaking the rules of narrative. I don't feel that it is, to be honest, because I think that feeling that that some things can't be explained, that there are that there's more here than we see, is so common among us. It's part of all of our stories in one way or another. That to actually include that in a novel feels realistic to me. Also, if you're writing fiction, there's nothing to say, well, if a man is walking down the sidewalk, well and good, but what if he's walking down the sidewalk and he's 6 inches above the ground? you can do things with fiction that you can't do otherwise. And that is just sort of a lovely, freeing thing. And so I always want to remain open to the possibility that the world is larger than we know. I think it's a human characteristic to want to build some mythology into your life, into your own history. Look, I'm named after a Viking navigator and explorer who crossed the ocean at a time when there were thunder gods and sea serpents. It would be dishonest, it would be disingenuous to write as if the world were small.
Well, there's two prominent examples of this in the book, and one of them is the man in the black suit. And you could maybe read a little section of him, or if you just want to talk about him, but I think it might be interesting to just hear a little bit about this prominent representative of mystery.
Yeah, I will. I had this marked, but there's a little breeze in my office here, and my bookmark flew away. Here he is. Yeah, this was actually the first thing that came to my mind when I was thinking about this story was actually this image that I'm going to read to you here. And this is early on, it's page 6. And he's just gotten out of the hospital after a week of recovery, and his friend Tom Beeman is driving him home. I listened to Tom. Tom is a wonderful talker. As best I could, he has a naturally comforting voice. But a bad concussion jangles everything. My mind was not clear. His gentle baritone came at me like elbows. The geo's elliptical progress plus the acute brightness of the world made me queasy. We developed a hand signal so Tom could pull over and allow me to puke. Resting on a swale of grass overlooking the lake, sweat cooling on my brow, I thought I saw a man out there. Not in a boat, just a man, standing upright on the shimmery surface of Lake Superior. The lake was so calm it looked concave. The man stood at ease, 100 yards out. He turned his head to look at me. I seemed to shrink, or the world to expand. "Do you see that?" I asked Beeman, who kept a civil distance. I pointed at the man on the lake. Beeman shrugged. "See what?" I didn't elaborate. The man smiled. He was way out there, but I could see him smiling right at me. He had a black suit on. He looked like a keyhole, or exclamation point, standing on the water. So here is a guy that just showed up early on in my thinking before I had a story at all. Yeah, and so, you know, that's a clue that he has some reason to be there. And the nice thing about writing fiction as opposed to non is that you can just go with a clue and see if it leads to something. And this fellow makes recurring appearances, and it wasn't until very late in the book that I realized what he was there to do and what he represented, and the turning point that he would represent in Virgil's life after during his recovery. He's actually kind of important, even though he doesn't take up much ink. He's not in there very often or for very long. But in fact, he has a part to play. And I was completely delighted when I realized he had a reason to be there and that I wasn't just wasting my time and wouldn't have to take him out in the next draft. Because, you know, that happens to a lot of things I think are going to be important. It's like, oh, this will be a knockout. And then I get to the end and I realize, oh, that had no purpose. It has to leave. But with the man on the water, he has a point and a purpose.
Ah, see, now that's so interesting about the writing process, because me as a reader, anyway, I thought like, oh, what a carefully thought out metaphor this was, you know, that placed so strategically through the book.
Well, and most things are like that. The guy on the water is a real anomaly for me. I don't usually get things that sort of come whole cloth and they're good and I leave them the way they came. But with him, yeah, that did.
Well, talking about the writing process, something I just have to ask about, Ed, is So one person who read the book told me, the plot, fine. But she said, the thing that really kept me reading is it's just such beautiful language. The writing is so good that it's just worth it for that. And
well, that's nice to hear, especially since the plot goes nowhere.
So you know, how do you create that language? What is your writing process? Is each sentence a carefully constructed, polished jewel?
Oh, man, it's just a lot of work. I mean, I really appreciate the compliment. I'm not a perfectionist about very much in my life at all. In fact, if you saw my house, you would realize, oh, here's a dude who is not a perfectionist. But I'm pretty careful about sentences and paragraphs. I really want them to, I want them to ring. If I can make them ring, I want them to ring. I want them to be authentic and as true as possible. And really, it's an ugly process, Bill, because I write pretty terrible first drafts. They're nothing to brag about. If you saw my first drafts, you would think, wow, what sort of undergrad is at work here? But I'm happy to go back and work sentences. And for me, the real fun is to take kind of a flabby paragraph and cut it back and cut it back and cut it back. It's 90% just cutting. And turn it into a short paragraph or a couple of sentences that actually do something, that pay their way. Mm-hmm. Then I'm really happy, and I just can't seem to let a paragraph go until it kind of does what I want it to do. And so really any beauty in the writing comes from that process. It's very workaday. There's not much inspiration.
Well, it's not extravagant writing. I think of somebody like Tom Robbins or somebody. Right. The ways that you describe. Well, I said we were going to come back to adjectives. Yeah. You know, you use adjectives. And you describe things. Your descriptions are evocative and.
Yeah, when I was.
Worked
when
well.
I was in my 20s, I lucked into a book called Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, Ann Tyler's terrific novel. And that set me on a course of reading a bunch of her stuff. And I really love her writing because it's never flashy. You never just go, oh, man, oh, what a knockout sentence. I mean, you don't do it very often. Because what she's up to is communicating an idea as clearly as possible. And there's so much, I emulate that whenever I can. I'm less interested in flash than in something being really crystal clear to a reader, whether it's describing a scene or describing a landscape or describing the interior response of one person to another. I just want it to be really as clear as possible. So if it's doing that, then I'm happy with it.
Well, the ideas that you communicate there, I didn't ask you about this before, but somewhere I read that you said, I don't plan out my themes. I don't, you know, I don't set out to write a book that is about X theme, but what do you feel are the themes here? Because there people... You get
sure,
get that out.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, I think it's totally fair to say I'm going to write a book about love and death. Choose a big theme and go for it. I think that's probably a good thing to do. That's not the way my mind works in particular. The way my mind works is a character shows up, and then I see that person is in a dilemma of some sort, and what are they going to do about it? You know, it's really a pedestrian approach. But the themes end up coming up because our lives are made out of themes and our big decisions are made out of themes. I think that in part the themes of this book are death and loss because I was losing a lot of people. you know, not just my folks, but Robin's folks left us while I was working hard on this story. And so I was really, I was kind of bereft. I was feeling, like I said before, kind of lonely. And so that clearly was a theme. But then also, you write in order to understand the way you were thinking. You know, like Faulkner famously said, I never know what I believe until I read what I have written. So you're trying to understand your own mind and your own heart. And so I think what that led to was a thematic kind of gratitude. Because the world, as hard as it got, was still really beautiful. And the sun kept coming up. And my kids, even though I was losing people on one end of my life, on the other end, my kids were getting married and having their own kids. And so that was reason to look not back, but forward. And so I think that thematically, it became a book about maintaining hope and moving toward a future that is maybe less stuck than the past.
Well, I would say that has something to do with some of the things that I heard people talk about getting out of it. You know, I have to ask you, are you ever going to publish anything that does not have kites and old movie theaters?
No, probably not. I mean, maybe. Who knows? Those are just such lovely topics, aren't they? I mean, you go into a movie, take old theaters. You go into one, and it doesn't matter if there's a movie showing. It doesn't matter if there are people in the seats. You walk in, and you smell the antiseptic and the dust and the... you know, generations of, you know, sometimes pleasant and sometimes vile smells that people have brought in with them or left behind them. But there's so many ghosts in old theaters that I love being around them. While I was writing this, we would sometimes go into Aiken. We lived outside of Aiken, Minnesota, and there's a great theater there called the Rialto. Single screen theater. I think it was built in 1937. And when I first started making notes for this story, I called the owner, Kirk Pazer, and said, "Kirk, will you show me your theater? Can I come in for an afternoon?" And he very generously spent an afternoon showing me how to spool up the film onto the projector and let me horse around up in the booth and showed me the stairway going up to the apartment that he rented out, and the basement and all the sort of spooky little spaces in this theater. And I just didn't want to leave. They're such evocative places. And the same holds for, I mean, baseball is like baseball feels like a door in the air for me that you can just sort of open up and walk through and you're in a different place. My dad was a ball player. My uncle, Clarence, was a ball player. Their dad, Buck Anger, was a ball player back in Depression era North Dakota. One thing that was cool about moving to Duluth is we've got this little Wade Stadium down here where I set the baseball scene with Alec pitching the perfect game. When our kids were small, we would drive over from Crosby, where we lived at the time, and we'd go to Duluth Dukes games. And at some point, I found out that my uncle Clarence, who had played in the Northern League back in the day, the first iteration of the Northern League, before it fell apart for a few years, Clarence had played in the Northern League, and so that meant that he had probably come to the Duluth Stadium and probably pitched a game or two there. So when we went and saw the Dukes, I was in the same ballpark that my uncle was all those years ago, throwing wild fastballs toward the plate. He walked a lot of guys, and he struck a lot of guys out. Really, really fun. It was so much fun just to put myself back in time And I felt that that allowed me access to a kind of magic that
isn't
always available to me, but was when I thought about that scene.
Yeah. Kites, I feel like we almost don't need to talk about kites because their nature in the book is so clear. You have a long relationship.
I do. Kites. Look, a kite is just physics, right? It's a piece of paper or cloth mounted on a rigid frame and attached to some string, and up it goes into the sky, and it's just nothing but physics and natural laws. And yet, I can remember as a kid trying to see how far I could get a kite up into the air and putting almost a mile of string on a lightweight kite and the wind taking it up and eventually it just disappearing because there was bad visibility and a haze in the air and the kite just went up and vanished. It was gone in the sky and yet I could feel it. And a kite always feels like a fish on a line. It tugs and it pulls and it dives this way and that, and it responds like a fish in that if it puts its shoulder down and starts diving to earth, you have only to just give it 40 or 50 feet as fast as you can, and just like a fish on a line, it'll pause, it'll reconsider, and it'll change direction and head back to safety. And so it feels like a really organic exercise to fly a kite. You feel like you're in touch with something that's alive, and in a way you are because wind is like spirit, you know? Wind is just living nature. And so to put a kite up there, it really makes you feel, whether it's just pure imagination or whether there's something actually to it, you feel like you're in touch with something strange and bigger and more powerful than yourself. It's just a lovely feeling. I can't get enough of it. And I tried to impart that through the character of Ruin to the reader.
Well, with the talk about kites, here is Sue with kites behind her
head.
Sue.
I recently finished your book, Leif, and loved it. I want the second one. I want to know where he goes from there.
I kind of do too.
That's great. All right, George.
Excellent. So there's a question from more than a few people, looks like, from Beth Ann Campbell and Coley Clares. Sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. But they said this book may, more than most, had a very movie-like feel to it. It seemed to be a good cross between Fargo and Big Fish. Obviously.
Oh, that's a huge compliment. I'll take that.
Excellent. Obviously, movies play a big role in the book, but might Virgil Wander be made for the big screen? Any considerations? And were movies part of the inspiration for the book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, movies are certainly part of the inspiration. The whole movie theater experience looms pretty large in the book. And theaters as gathering places, you know. I mean, what could be better than going to a theater? And it's like the doors close and it's like you're in a boat with 50 other people and you're all headed to the same destination, but everybody has a different experience, you know. That's just a lovely way to spend an afternoon, I think. As for a movie rendition of Virgil, and no one has approached me about it. I have representation, but so far as I know, no one has had the slightest interest. I'm not holding my breath for a movie version. It's hard to get these things made, you know.
It is. All right. Brenna brings up the question, the statement, this book is about second chances. Yeah. Is there a second chance that you were given in your own life that changed your life?
Oh, yeah, there really was. And it was instrumental with this story. I wrote a draft of this, like I mentioned to Bill, and I was done with the draft, but I hadn't yet showed it to anybody. I was wondering if I should send it to my literary agent, but I wasn't comfortable with it. And then before I could do anything about it, I got really sick. I got a rare strain of meningitis that took a long time to diagnose and was characterized by really high fevers and sort of, you know, abrupt bouts of dizziness, and I couldn't keep anything down. And I just got really ill in a way that I hadn't before. I've been very lucky health-wise. And suddenly I was, I dropped a ridiculous amount of weight in about 2 weeks, and I wasn't a big guy before. And I could hear my bones bumping into each other if I climbed a staircase. It was very unnerving to me to suddenly be that ill. And the other thing that happened, once they diagnosed it, and they put me on a medication that took care of it, but the recovery was still some months. And during that time, I couldn't, I sort of lost the use of my eyes. I could see, but I couldn't concentrate on a page. My mind was not clear. I couldn't formulate a clear sentence. I wondered if I would ever be able to write again. I really hoped that I could, because I had this novel that I wanted to finish and send out. But it was by no means a certainty that I would still be able to write books. And I found that really scary and really depressing. And so when finally I kind of emerged from that, then I went back and I opened the manuscript that I hadn't looked at in months. And I thought, oh no, I've written a terrible book. It just wasn't very good, and there were a lot of problems with it. So I deleted it. I threw it away. I didn't have a printout, and I deleted the file so I wouldn't be tempted to use it as a kind of crutch. And I started from scratch, still using Greenstone, but making the theater owner the major character and the teller of the story, changing up the voice, and the whole thing just took on a different. But it was definitely a second chance. But once I hit the voice of Virgil, it's not like the book wrote itself. It was still really hard work, and I still had to really work to make my sentences good. It was harder work than I had ever done. But I felt that it was my second chance. The book itself was my second chance. Coming out of the illness was a second chance, and I was so grateful for it. And I still am. I'm terribly, terribly grateful. A really, really terrific doctor made that discovery. I'd spent a week at a hospital, a rural hospital, that was just perplexed and didn't know what to do with me. And so I went down to Abbott Northwestern, and they were perplexed. But Dr. Sanchez there just said, I'm not going to let this go. I'm going to figure whatever this, however long it takes, I'm going to figure this out. Because nobody wants to be the guy with the mystery illness. And he did. He figured it out. And it was a rare meningitis that isn't often seen. And when it is seen, is pretty deadly. So, boy, they have my gratitude forever.
Wow, absolutely. Speaking a little bit about illness, a few people had questions about if you had any research on traumatic brain injury for Virgil Wander. Deborah Elhart and Michelle Steinmore were wondering if you have any personal experience or how you went about researching that.
Yeah, the research was pretty much all anecdotal, because one of my oldest friends in the world and a neighbor of mine for many years was in a car accident and suffered a pretty bad head injury. And what happened to her was that she immediately lost her adjectives. That sounds like kind of a fanciful thing. Well, I lost my adjectives, but that comes from life. That was her experience. She didn't lose her other parts of speech, but for someone who likes to describe things, losing your adjectives is a pretty big deal. I remember going to visit to see how she was a week or two after the accident, and she had a Webster's dictionary on the table and a notebook, and she was copying adjectives out of the dictionary into the notebook. She said, I'm just trying to regain the ones I lost. And I think that she pretty much has. I think that she did. But she was dizzy, like Virgil experiences moments of vertigo. So did she. there was a genuine sort of lack of clarity, especially like late in the day, when things just became hazy, and she would sort of lose track of details, and all of that eventually was mitigated. I think she would tell you herself that she is almost all the way back. I would tell you that she actually maybe has more adjectives than she used to because of all that time with the dictionary. But that was the extent of my research. And what's interesting is that three or four readers have reached out and sent me emails just to say, wow, this kind of mirrors my own experience. I too lost descriptors. I lost parts of speech. It took a long time for them to return. So I was glad that that had the feel of verisimilitude for some readers. But thank you for asking that question.
All right. So Pamela said, I noted you used brand names frequently. For example, cars, heaters, writing tablets. So two questions. Do you use this as a tool to describe something with few words? And then I was surprised you didn't name lava soap.
Oh, I didn't think of it. Next book. Lava's going in there. Product placement. No, it's... I think it probably is a kind of shorthand. I try not to do too much of that. Once in a while, you see that in the books of Stephen King, for example, uses a lot of brand names. And I think it's a very effective shorthand. If you say lava, everybody knows what you're talking about. And it speaks to a certain sort of business-like frame of mind, I think. If you're using lava, you don't care that much about your skin, for one thing. That's a good question. I don't do it too much. And in the second or third draft, I did take out a number of other things that I felt. Those can sort of take you out of the moment if you do it too often. I think they can remove the flow of the story. John Gardner, who was a terrific novelist and writing teacher, who died, I think, in the 1980s, wrote in a really good book about how to write novels, that what you're after is the feel of a vivid, continuous dream. He said, don't do anything that wakes the reader. For me, it's things like, you know, too many brand names or too many jumps to different points of view. I think many novels are written that way very effectively. I mean, Louise Erdrich, for example, writes multiple points of view in a way that I just wish I could do. She's so good at it, and she writes such elegant books. My brother Lynn, his novels can shift around from viewpoint to viewpoint, and it's very effective. The people who are good at it do an elegant job. That was what I did in my first rendition of the Greenstone story that turned into Virgil Wander, and I was unable to do it in a way that made me happy. I felt like I was always jarring the reader out of that vivid, continuous dream. And so to try to achieve it, I went back to the reliable first-person voice, because then it's one viewpoint all the way through, and you learn to trust him and rely on him.
That's wonderful. Pat has a pretty good question here that might tie into some of the mythological Norse myth that you and Bill spoke about earlier. She was curious about the sturgeon that takes on mythological importance to Shad's son. She said it reminds her of the golden carp and black bass and Bless Me Ultima or the quest for Moby Dick.
Well, that's a great question. I envisioned this boy
as a young Ahab, kind of obsessed with a big fish that he is convinced has killed his dad. But the nice thing again about writing fiction as opposed to none is that you are free to say, well, wait a minute now. What if there's something to what Galen thinks? What if many things can be true at one time? What if there is something more to this big fish than just simply a big sturgeon? What if he's more than that at the same time? That was something that was terribly fun to mess around with, and I had to really ask whether I was willing to go down that road, and how many people would be willing to go down it with me. And so I consciously wrote it in a way that if you're comfortable with the idea of a fish that is maybe more than a fish, or a man that is more than a man, then you can absolutely read it that way, and it takes on a mythological tone. But if for you a tree is only ever a tree, then you can read it that way too, and it will not disrupt your mind too terribly much. It was enormous fun to write that and to write the sturgeon. Again, years ago, my sons and I went on a trout fishing expedition to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and we were sort of driving around Hemingway country and going to some of his favorite rivers and streams, and we drove up to Ontonagon on the shore of Superior, and there's an old pier there that is kind of disused, and there was a kid that was fishing from the top of this pier, like an ore dock, you know, one of those ore docks as in Greenstone with the, it rises out of the water 30 or 40 feet on these big black bones. And there was a kid up there with like raggedy clothes, and he was completely Huckleberry Finn. He was just a modern Finn. And the boys and I walked up and climbed onto the pier, and we were talking to this kid. The wind was blowing so hard, it was blowing the tops off of the waves, and it was picking sand up off the beach and blowing it through your clothes so it stuck to your skin. And this kid was catching fish off this pier and pulling them up, you know, 30 feet into the air. And he was telling us, you know, here's how you catch a fish here. We're like, it was early in the season, school was still going on. We're like, is school out today? And he's like, no. Like, are you going to make something? I mean, he was just this tough little kid. And I just, I loved that. He was almost a caricature of a wild boy, a feral boy. I loved him. And I wanted to write somebody that would pay homage to that sort of endangered species. That is that kid who just all he thinks about day and night is catching the big fish. God, what a specimen he was. I'd love to know what happened to him.
At this point, we had an internet moment. Leif's screen froze up, and he couldn't hear us anymore, but we could still hear him. So we texted him, and he managed to get in his farewell.
If you can still hear me, let me just say that I'm really grateful for the chance to have done this. This was a lot of fun, and I wish you the best, and thank you so much for the chance to be part of this program. Thank you all. And now, since it's about 5:30, I think I'm going to say good day.
And so we will also say farewell. This is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. Thanks to Humanities ND. This is their project, One Book, One North Dakota. Sue Skaliski and George Welder there helped make this whole thing happen. And they got special support for this from the Paris Family Foundation. And you can find out more about it and the many other webinars that are part of this series by going to humanitiesnd.org.